Hierdie inset word aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.
Dit is baie lekker om weer vandag met jou te gesels rondom die heerlike woord van die Here. En deur sy gees ook die krag van die Here sy teenwoordigheid te kan belewe. So baie welkom by die ABBA program Krag van die Bybel, Krag van die Woord. Ons gaan, soos gewoonlik, in die eerste deel van die program weer vandag, die Bible Projects, se potgooi reeks, The Exodus Way, nou luister, en vandagse episode gaan oor hoe Paulus die Exodus taal gebruik in sy briewe aan die vroeg-christelike gemeentes van wie hy geskryf het. Paul and the New Exodus People. Dit is die episode se naam. Dit is lekker om na hierdie gesprek te luister, want daar's baie maniere waarop ons werklik in die teenwoordigheid van die Here kan kom. En die dinge wat so aandring op ons, net vir 'n oomblik kan laat gaan. Wat hierdie program gaan oor, hoe hoor ek die Here, hoe lees ek die Bybel, en hoe kan ek die krag van die woord, die lewende woord van God, dan ervaar. Jy kan ook natuurlik gaan na Kaapse Kansel by 021-180-5744 en dan sal jy onmiddellik toegang kan kry tot 'n berader wat in groot konfidensialiteit ook na jou kan luister oor juist daai dinge wat die bekommernisse van elke dag en die dinge wat op jou hart lê en net saam met luister na jou en saam met jou bid rondom dit. Maak gebruik daarvan. Dit is van maandag tot vrydag beskikbaar by Kaapse Kansel. Gaan gerus ook na die Kaapse Kansel webwerf en laai die toepassing, die app, laai dit gerus af en luister na die programme in drie tale, in Afrikaans, in Engels en in isiXhosa. Dit is wonderlik om dit so te deel, maandagoggende tot vrydagoggende het ons ook die program saam met Disa wat van Kaapse Kansel uitgesaai word en dan ook in die aande, in die middag, 3 tot 6 uur, het ons Disa, waar dit van Disa se kant af kom, en dan deel ons dit ook op Kaapse Kansel. Jy kan ook, as jy wil opleiding kry oor hoe om ander mense te help in berading, kan jy ook gaan na ABBO se webwerf, abbo.org.za, en kyk gerus na die kursusse wat jy wil doen en skakel in, soos dit daar vir jou aangelei word. Ons wil regtig net tot rus te kom, wanneer ons ook luister nou na die gesprek van Tim en John by Bible Projects. Ons gaan luister na hulle in hierdie potgooi, waar hulle dan juist gesels na Jesus se dood, hoe die Christene sy dood, sy opstanding en sy hemelvaart en met die uitstorting van die gees, sy gees wat hy gestuur het, nadat hy opgevaar het, hoe hierdie nuwe gelowiges wat dwarsdeur die Ou Testament kom en dan die Nuwe Testament vir ons dit verhaal vir ons soos in Handelinge, hoe hierdie mense dan bekend staan as die mense van die weg. As hulle gepraat het van die weg, dan praat hulle van die nuwe Christene, of die Christene, die wat Jesus se volgers. Eintlik is die weg dan in die taal, het dit te doen ook met Israel wat die uittog uit Egipte. Hulle gaan op die pad, op die weg. En dan gaan hulle op die pad deur die Rooi See. En hulle gaan op die pad deur die woestyn. Hulle gaan uiteindelik deur die Jordaan na die beloofde land. En dan gesels hulle hoe ons dit ook dieselfde temas nou nog vandag ook in ons lewe ervaar. Dit is die pad van Jesus deur die woestyn van ons wêreld, hoe as ons hom volg op hierdie pad, deur sy gees en sy woord, deur die woestyn van ons huidige wêreld, die wêreld waar jy en ek nou vandag lewe, op pad dat die toegang tot die beloofde nuwe skepping, wanneer Jesus weer terugkom na hierdie aarde en alles nuut maak. In hierdie vroeg-christelike kerk was Paulus 'n baie sentrale figuur in die hele beweging van die mense van die weg. Die opgestaane Jesus het aan hom verskyn en hom opdrag gegee om die goeie nuus van die uittog uit die slawerny en die deurtog deur hierdie woestyn na die beloofde land, om hierdie nuus te versprei oor die hele bekende wêreld van daardie tyd. Hy het kerke in verskeie Romeinse stede geplant en briewe aan hulle geskryf. Aan gemeentes wat bestaan het uit Jode en nie Jode, wat almal gelowig geword het in 'n baie neerdrukkende, moeilike wêreld. En Paulus, wat 'n Joodse man was, opgelei in die skrifte van Israel en die Ou Testament so goed geken het, sien ons hom hoe hy die Eksodus taal en beelde gebruik in sy briewe aan die vroeë kerk. So in hierdie episode gesels dan Tim en John oor hierdie briewe van Paulus aan die kerke in Korinthe en Galasië en Rome, en ontdek hoe Paulus die dood en die opstanding van Jesus, die lewe van die Christen en die grootte verhaal van die skepping, hoe hy dit alles sien as 'n groot wêreld, kosmiese uittog, en hoe die Here ons lei deur dit vandag nog totdat hy kom in sy volle beloofde land. Geniet dit en bly ingeskakel. Ons gesels dan in die tweede deel van die program verder oor Matteus. Dis baie lekker om jou saam te hê, en ons wil ook graag terugvoer van jou hê van die program. WhatsApp stuur gerus aan Kaapse Kansel.
Welcome to Bible Project Podcast. One of the largest themes in the story of the Bible is the Exodus. It's the road out of slavery, the road through the wilderness, and the road into the land of promise. Now, gospel authors, they intentionally frame the story of Jesus as a new Exodus, with Jesus as the new Moses. And he came to confront the spiritual powers that empower human evil and enslave us all.
So he's there to confront that Pharaoh, a spiritual Pharaoh. He would go first through the death night of Passover ahead of his people to open up a way out the other side.
Jesus is also the blameless life represented in the Passover lamb.
God participates in the pain as the one who can deliver us out of it.
And so the first followers of Jesus called themselves the Way. They are the Exodus people who are on the road out of slavery, the road through the wilderness, awaiting a future inheritance, a time when all creation is renewed. Now, a central figure in this movement is the Apostle Paul, who traveled through the Roman Empire, declaring the new Exodus, planting churches made up of Jews and Gentiles. On today's episode, we're going to look at how the Apostle Paul used Exodus metaphors to address the real-life problems facing the churches that he planted. For example, Paul tells the church to continue to celebrate the Feast of Passover.
Paul sees all of Christian life as an ongoing celebration of Passover. It's a perpetual celebration of our liberation from bondage.
In the letter to the Galatians, Paul tells the church to walk the road of the Exodus by following God's Spirit, just like Israel followed God's glory through the wilderness.
He's turned the road out into something Jesus did on your behalf, but now you have to choose to walk that road out yourself with the glory of God guiding you, the Spirit.
And just like Israel was groaning in slavery under Pharaoh and God heard them, Paul talks about how all of creation is groaning, but we groan with hope.
That hope was that creation itself would be set free from slavery to decay into the glorious freedom of the children of God.
In fact, when you start looking for it, you begin to realize that the Apostle Paul was constantly referencing the Exodus story.
Paul thought of the death and resurrection of Jesus in Passover Exodus terms. He thought of the life of a Christian as a perpetual enactment of the Exodus story, and he sees all of creation as an Exodus cosmic story.
Today, Tim Mackey and I wrap up this series looking at how the Apostle Paul infuses the Exodus story into his letters to the Corinthians, Galatians, and Romans. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Hey, Tim.
John, hello.
Hello. We are into a theme called the New Exodus. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have, yes.
And I've really enjoyed this series.
Oh, good.
It's such a meta series.
Yeah, yes. So what I want to look at is look at just one of the apostles' writings, the one whose letter correspondence we have the most of, the Apostle Paul, and see how does the Exodus motif work itself out in the writings of Paul. We know that the Apostle Paul thought deeply about the meaning of the Exodus story and the meaning of Passover, and that he understood from the traditions he received about Jesus that Jesus saw his own death and resurrection in terms of a replay or a fulfillment of the Exodus. There's one passage in particular in the letter we call 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where it's not even his main point to talk about the Exodus. He's actually confronting a house church because there's a guy in there who says he follows Jesus, but he's sleeping with his mother-in-law. And the church is doing nothing about it. In fact, some people in the church are like, what a liberated sexual ethic we have here. At the Church of Corinth. Paul's like, dude, you guys are so off the farm. So he says in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6, your boasting is not good. Like, it's the opposite of good. Don't you know that a little leaven will spread leaven throughout the whole lump of dough?
This is yeast. Leaven is yeast.
Yeah. Yep. Yeast. Yeah. Yep. You know, like many people in the pandemic, my wife took up sourdough making and we all benefit. We all, meaning myself and my two sons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fresh sourdough.
Mm.
Oh. Like right out of the oven.
Oh, okay.
You know?
I believe.
Oh, she actually has a starter and she cares for it and feeds it. And it's a jar.
Wait, so the starter is like a little lump of dough.
The starter is a little living creature in a jar.
Oh my gosh.
That's fermenting the materials in it. It's like a little gooey substance.
Yeah.
And she'll take out some of it and put it in.
And then mix it into the whole dough.
To a big thing of dough.
And
then leave it overnight.
And as it spreads out, that's what's going to let the sourdough rise.
So that's Paul's metaphor. He's describing this guy sleeping with his mother-in-law. And saying, like,
a little gooey substance.
I'm a liberated Christian as just that little gooey thing.
Hmm.
And he's like, listen, if you don't, like, do something about this, he's going to infect. Now I'm using a different metaphor.
It's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
It's an infection of sorts. In bread making, you want the infection.
That's right. Now, Paul's drawing on the image of leaven spreading as a negative image, like a bad thing spreading. Jesus drew on the leaven image.
Oh, in the
positively,
kingdom of God.
Yeah.
Yeah, parable.
So the metaphor can have different meanings. So
you're talking about the parable where Jesus says the kingdom of God is like
a bit of leaven.
A bit of leaven that goes through the dough.
Yeah. A woman hides in the dough and it spreads. And there it's good. Here, the leaven spreading is bad. Where did he get that idea? Why is he drawing on this idea now? Verse 7. So clean out the old leaven so that you can be a new lump, just as you are, in fact, unleavened.
You are unleavened.
Yeah. So he's saying, take out the leaven.
So to be a people who live in right relationship with each other and with God is to be unleavened.
Unleavened, yeah.
And so leaven is the corruption.
Leaven is the corruption. And then look at what he says. This is fascinating. So take out the leaven, which by which he's going to mean like you need to tell that guy that if he keeps sleeping with his mother-in-law, that he can't be a part of this community until he stops doing that. So that's what he's going to tell him to do. And so clean out the old leaven so that you can be a new lump. And look, it's so cool because you are, in fact, an unleavened lump of dough. It's sort of like be who you are. You are God's holy people. Mm-hmm. So you're not acting like it, but that's what you are.
Okay.
So be who you are. So all of this is coming from the Feast of Unleavened Bread, where Israelites would remove leaven from their homes and eat unleavened bread for the week after Passover.
Because on the first Passover, they didn't have time to leaven their bread.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
They just had to go.
Yeah. So there the symbol was as a symbol of the haste.
The haste.
The hurry.
Like when you're free, don't wait.
Don't dally. When God opens up the way out of bondage.
You're going.
Leave.
You're not going to stop and make some leavened bread.
Mm-mm, not wait 4 hours for it to rise. So Paul both adapts this metaphor from the feast of Passover and unleavened bread, but then he tweaks its meaning. It's cool. Then he says, so clean out the old leaven so that you can be a new lump, because that's what you really are, because the Messiah, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with the old leaven, not with the leaven of malice or wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So what's interesting is Paul talks about the Messiah, our Passover lamb. He just throws that in there. Like, they'll just know what it means. He doesn't explain it.
And the Passover lamb in the first Exodus, Moses' Exodus, was the animal that you took and you prepared for the night of Passover to eat.
Yep. Save the firstborn sons from dying by the plague destroyer that was entering homes. God wouldn't allow death to touch the homes of those covered with the blood of the Passover lamb.
The blood of the Passover lamb was an intermediating force.
Yeah. Yeah. A protective force.
That kept the plague.
Yeah. At bay.
Death at bay.
That's right. So Paul takes that idea that Jesus set in motion by timing his death to come at Passover. And then Paul's just putting those pieces together, but he doesn't explain it. That's what's great about this passage. It assumes that Paul had a whole Bible study with these people that now he can just pull on that idea in one sentence. Mm. And then what he goes on to say next is really interesting. Then he says, therefore, let us celebrate, present tense, ongoing, the feast. In other words, Paul sees all of Christian life as a
Passover feast,
as an ongoing celebration of Passover.
Mm.
It's a perpetual celebration of our liberation from bondage. That when we gather, when we take the bread and the cup, the replays Jesus' Passover meal, it's like we are constantly living and embodying and replaying the Exodus reality that Jesus accomplished on our behalf.
Yeah.
There was an early church scholar, a guy named John Chrysostom, which means golden mouth. He was one of the most famous preachers in Constantinople in the 4th century. And he put it this way, the whole of time in which we live is a festival.
Mm.
For though Paul said, let us keep the feast, he did not say it with a view to the presence of Passover or even of Pentecost, but is pointing out that the whole of time is a festival unto Christians. So good. So in one sense, symbolically, Passover began, right? Like that weekend.
When Jesus broke
2000
the bread with
ago.
His disciples.
Yeah. And we
continue to feast.
Yeah, we let us celebrate the feast. So this is such a dense little passage.
Yeah.
But what it shows us is Paul had a whole set of Bible studies with new followers of Jesus when he planted churches. Paul planted this group of house churches in Corinth. He lived there for a year and a half and got to know these people. And one of the things he taught them was about how the Exodus story is the framework to understand the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus and what it means for Christian life in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's true, this little passage, it's sort of like it's a key, then what it means is, well, where else might I find Exodus influence in Paul's writings where he's less explicit? So I'm kind of trying to build argument here that if he's explicit about it here, and he assumes a whole tradition of teaching that he gave people about it, I think that gives us good grounds to go out to other passages in his writings and look for Exodus language. And I was first introduced to this way, looking for Exodus language in Paul, through the work of N.T. Wright, very influential New Testament scholar. But I remember it was in his footnotes where he said he learned, or was really tipped off by this, by the work of a New Testament scholar, Sylvia Kiesmatt, in a book called Paul and His Story, Reinterpreting the Exodus Tradition. And Kiesmatt's work goes through Paul's letter to the Galatians and the Romans and finds Exodus language all over. So I'll read from her conclusion right here, and then I just want to look at some passages because it's so cool. So this is from the conclusion of her book. She says, in the light of my reading of Galatians, it seems evident that Paul not only echoed and alluded to Exodus motifs and themes in his language, he also told the story of the Galatian Christians as a new Exodus story. The whole movement of the book, and she's referring to not Exodus, but to Galatians, from slavery to sonship, that is adoption as God's children, to the desire to go back and return to slavery, the threat of disinheritance, that is the threat of losing the promised land, reflects the structure of the Exodus story as it's found in Israel's scripture. The narrative of the Exodus as a whole undergirds Paul's telling of the Galatian experience and provides an interpretation of that experience throughout the letter. And then she concludes, so this story had an identity-shaping role in Israel's tradition. Remember, every generation sees itself as the generation that came out of Egypt by celebrating Passover.
And every year you do it.
So Paul's retelling had a similar function for the Galatian church.
Okay.
So let's turn to the letter to the Galatians. So he's writing to a network of house churches that he knows have been visited by Messianic Jewish missionaries who he has some important theological differences with.
Mm-hmm.
So these are followers of Jesus who are Jewish and think that non-Israelites, if they're going to follow the Jewish Messiah, need to begin observing the key identity markers of the Jewish law that come from the Torah.
Yeah, like eating kosher. Mm-hmm. And the festivals.
Yep. Males being circumcised. Sabbath. Yep.
Yeah.
And Paul's point was they can if they want. Jewish followers of Jesus can and do continue in those practices. But non-Israelite followers of Jesus don't have to do those things in order to be part of the family of Jesus Messiah. And then that was a whole big thing. Worked out in the book of Acts. We could reference people back to our Luke Acts series where we
talk about that.
Traced that. That was a long time ago. We did that. So that's the crisis he's addressing, is he feels like the good news about Jesus is being compromised because all of a sudden you're trying to do something that God's already done on your behalf. That's the basic logic of his argument. That's why he begins right out of the gate with the first sentences. Grace and peace to y'all from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Messiah, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from the present evil age according to the will of our God and Father. So that little opening line there, he gave himself for our sins. Different English translations go different directions. To rescue us, to set us free.
Oh, this is the word that you said deliver.
Yeah. So the Greek word he uses, exaireo, which means to take something out of.
It's got the X in there.
Yeah, out. X. Yep, X means out of, and then aireo means to take or remove.
Okay.
This is the Greek word used by the Jewish scholars who translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek centuries before Jesus. This is one of the main Greek words used for the Hebrew word yatsa, which means to go out of, which is the key word.
Okay. I was going to ask, Egypt. Like, he could have used the word exodus.
Mm-hmm. And in essence, he's using
But he is, in
a word loaded from the Exodus story.
That Hebrew word,
Yatzah.
Yatzah is the word to go out.
To go out from.
And that's the key word in the Exodus narratives throughout the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. And you're saying in Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, that word is exareo.
Yep, exareo. And it's just one example. There's many, but I'll just one. So from Exodus chapter 3, which is from the burning bush. God tells Moses for the first time, here's what I'm going to do. Exodus 3, verse 8, I have come down to deliver my people from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up from that land to a land flowing with milk and honey. So that word to deliver, natzal in Hebrew, which means, again, to snatch away from. Mm-hmm. But later Greek translators rendered that with exaireo, to take out of.
Okay.
And that's the word that Paul draws on right here. So this raises that interesting question of like, so did he mean for that word to be loaded with the whole Exodus story? And this is where Sylvia Kiesmott is saying, well, just wait and see. Keep reading.
Deliver us from, and then you would imagine the slavery would be the thing.
Yes.
And then what he brings up is
the present evil age.
Present evil age is the Pharaoh.
There's some kind of Pharaoh to whom we're in bondage. And that Pharaoh is characterized as having power over us in the present evil age. So he's referring to a whole era, whole time era, of life outside of Eden, as it were.
Okay.
Or life in Egypt. Yeah. So that's the opening line. It's a little hint that this is going to be a story and a letter where he's trying to tell them, you've already been delivered. You don't need to do anything to try and deliver yourself again.
Okay.
It's already happened. It's a become who you are type of argument, like he used with the Corinthians. So who is he in slavery to? He actually narrows in on that point. So in Galatians 4, Paul develops this metaphor that the Galatians were like little children who had a like an overseer assigned to them. This would be really common in the Greco-Roman world, where parents who had means would hire a teacher, but like a live-in teacher. He calls it a pedagogue in Greek, paedagogos. Okay. It means a child leader, the leader of a child.
Yeah.
But it's like a live-in nanny.
But also instructor.
But also a teacher.
Okay.
To kind of raise your kid for you. So Paul draws on this practice.
Yeah.
And he says, listen, when we were underage, we had actually been under the leadership and authority over a really bad paedagogos.
So being underage in Paul's metaphor means before the being in the Messiah?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Humans before the arrival of the Messiah.
Okay.
So he says in verse 3, you know, when we were little kids, we were in slavery to the elemental spiritual forces of the world.
Elemental.
Okay. So he uses a Greek word, stoicheia, which is a deep rabbit hole that we've explored in our God series about spiritual beings in the New Testament.
I'm not remembering.
Yes, I mean, that was 4 years ago.
It's probably more,
More.
The stoicheia is the stoicheia. Word for elemental?
Yeah, it's a fascinating word that was used in biblical literature, but it's not used very often. It's used mostly in outside the New Testament Greek literature to refer to, I mean, what we call like the elements. Think of the classic elements like earth, wind, and fire.
Okay, those elements?
So
not like hydrogen, oxygen.
Well, I mean, that's how we imagine them in the modern sense, but that's the secularized version of how most people thought of them throughout history, which is they were divinized. They were godlike.
Okay.
They were deities.
Okay.
The gods of fire, the gods of wind, the gods of...
Okay.
So it's a way of imagining the universe that all of the ordered patterns that make creation cohere, it's the work of the gods. And there were gods for everything. There were gods of justice, gods of order, gods of war, gods of sex.
These are the elementals.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. And he sees that the Galatians being just, you know, first century, just living in the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Up in the north of what today we call Turkey. They were just, you know, worshiping the sun, worshiping the moon, worshiping sex, worshiping war.
As you do.
Like, that's just what humans do. So he says, we were in slavery to that. But when the time had fully come, God sent his son. So think of a raising up of a Moses here. People are in slavery. God raises up a deliverer.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Born of a woman. So he's referring to Mary.
Yeah.
But he's echoing the emphasis of Moses' birth story, being born to a woman.
Okay.
Born under the Torah.
So he's an Israelite, a faithful Israelite.
He's an Israelite who lives under the Torah in order to redeem those under the Torah.
That is Israel.
That is Israel. So God sent an Israelite Messiah who lived as a part of the covenant relationship between God and Israel. However, that covenant relationship embodied in the laws of the Torah ended up bringing death to Israel, not life. He doesn't work it out in detail here. He does in the letter to the Romans. But he sees the laws of the Torah as being God's good wisdom and will revealed to Israel for how to live. But that sin, like a snake, keeps whispering in our ears so that even our best efforts to live according to the will of God get hijacked or just like, you know, reversed. And we end up doing what we don't want to do and not doing what we do want to do. So paradoxically, the Torah becomes hijacked by the elemental spiritual forces of the world. So he came to redeem us.
Redeem is the Exodus.
And redeem is the Exodus word.
Yeah.
So he sees non-Israelites as being enslaved to the spiritual forces of the world. And then he sees Israel as being enslaved to the forces of sin and death that make the law a tool of death that brought death to Israel. But what if we had an Israelite who would be born under the law but fulfill the law? And live a life fully in sync with the will of God so that we might all receive adoption to become sons.
And the we now is?
Everybody.
Everybody.
Israelite and non-Israelite.
Okay.
So notice he's thinking through the whole biblical story about Israel and the nations, and that Israel's exodus was on behalf of all of the nations. But Israel's first exodus led them to Mount Sinai to receive the laws of the Torah, which ended up killing them. Not because the laws are bad, but because humans are humans.
Yeah.
So what if we had a new Moses, right? Born among the enslaved ones, and he was the one to lead us out and redeem us and take us on a journey so that we, Israel and non-Israelites, might receive adoption to become children. So here, Sophia Kismet has this whole thing where she thinks all that language is echoing the making of the covenant at Sinai, which happens at the road in between, which is where God marries Israel and where they become his family.
So adoption is saying you're now part of that covenant.
Yeah. Exodus chapter 19, I brought you out of Egypt, carried you on eagle's wings, and if you listen to me and obey the terms of the covenant, you will be my special possession, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And that special possession gets developed throughout the Torah to them being God's children, God's family, God's spouses, God's covenant family.
So it's a mixed metaphor.
Yes.
It could be a spouse, it could be a child.
Yes.
Inheritor, essentially.
Yeah, to family that's adopted in to inherit the family inheritance.
Yeah.
That is all Exodus language. So Paul goes on. He says, so, verse 7, you are no longer slaves, but God's child. And if you're his child, God has also made you an inheritor.
Yeah.
Which is the primary language used to describe the road in.
The promised land.
To the promised land.
Yeah.
This is super condensed.
You got slavery, which is why we need the road out. You've got the adoption, which was in the road between. And then you've got the inheritance, which is the road in.
Yep. This is exactly the structure of the Exodus story. Slavery, redemption, sonship, inheritance. So then, if you think about the road to Mount Sinai was all about becoming God's covenant partners, which Israel never did very well. That was the point of the Hebrew Bible. But ideally, that's what a new Exodus people would do, is finally live according to the will of God. So Paul develops this theology then of being led by the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5. This is really cool. So in verse 13, he says, so you, my brothers and sisters, you were called to be free.
You've been exodused.
Yeah, you're liberated. But don't use that freedom as a chance to indulge the desires of your body, the flesh. Rather, you should serve one another humbly in love. For the whole Torah is fulfilled in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself.
You got that from Jesus.
Verse 16, so I say, walk by the Spirit. Notice the road imagery, walking along a road. And who are you being led by?
Well, the Israelites were led by fire.
Yeah, the pillar of fire and cloud.
Yeah.
So he's turned the road out into something Jesus did on your behalf. But now you have to choose to like walk that road out yourself. With the glory of God guiding you, which he puts in the slot of the glory cloud, the Spirit. So walk by the Spirit, and you won't gratify the desires of your flesh. The flesh wants what is contrary to the Spirit, Spirit contrary to the flesh. You know, you're in a flesh bag. You're in a body outside of Eden that's going back to the dust. So that's going to have all these loaded desires. But that the new creation identity of who you are and where your body's headed to, a new creation led by the Spirit, that's going to have a whole set of other desires. That's going to desire to live in sync with the will of God and loving your neighbor as yourself. So here's the deal. If you are led by the Spirit and you're a non-Israelite, you don't have to live under the laws of the Torah, that is, the things that were being made the condition by those other missionaries who came to the Galatians, that the ritual observances of the Torah, even a Passover itself, are pointers and symbols to the greater reality of what God would do in and through the Messiah. So he's saying that's what the Hebrew Bible is leading you by turning Passover and the Exodus story into symbols for a future Exodus. So he's just carrying the logic of the Hebrew Bible forward and saying the Torah and its commands are good. And they were given to Israel for a specific purpose and season and role among the nations. However, once the Messiah came, he came as the Messiah for Israel and the nations. And if the nations want to get in on the party, they don't have to observe those ritual observances.
Yet they do need to live in a way that
fulfills the wisdom of the laws.
And the Spirit can give you that.
That's right. And he's saying that's what the Spirit will lead you to do. And in a way, what he's just developing for a non-Jewish audience the main ideas of the Sermon on the Mount. Because Jesus' audience was primarily Israelite, and Paul's audiences were both, but he really, really wanted to make sure he included people who weren't a part of the Israelite tradition. So I think what's interesting here, again, is that the Exodus language isn't the focus. What he's actually doing is putting out a fire in this church.
Yeah.
But he draws on the Exodus language as an assumed framework, assumed storyline, to help the Galatians see themselves as being led through the wilderness. And ironically, the road out and the road in between, which in the first Exodus story led them to Mount Sinai to receive the laws of the Torah. But in Paul's re-narrating of the new Exodus, the laws of the Torah become, actually he calls it the Torah of the Messiah, later in the letter to the Galatians, the law of Christ.
And what is he referring to?
Love God and love your neighbor to be led by the Spirit. Which might on the surface lead some non-Israelites, Christians, to say, you know, we're going to do Sabbath a little bit differently on a different day of the week or in totally a different way, but we want to learn from its wisdom.
Yeah.
And that should be okay that we do that, that we pull that move. We're still followers of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah.
Yeah.
And Paul wants Israelite Christians to accept their non-Israelite brothers and sisters who might practice things a little bit differently. That's basically what it comes down to.
Right.
But the churches were splitting over these issues, and he saw that as the greater tragedy.
Yeah.
So it's a good example of what Sylvia Kiesmatt's talking about. So that's Galatians. There's more passages we could look at. There's more that Sylvia Keesmaat focuses on, but that is a little sampling. I want to draw our attention to a passage in Romans chapter 8, which again, Keesmaat's work really just helped me see new layers here. It's the point in Romans chapter 8 where he's talking about how, man, if we really are the liberated Exodus crew, we've been freed from slavery, then why is it that life just is still really terrible for so many of us?
Yeah.
And we're dying and we're sick. And I mean, these early Christians were persecuted by their neighbors. So he's trying to reframe all of that. And in Romans 8, verse 18, he says, so listen, I consider the sufferings of the present time, they're not even worthy when you compare them with the honor or the glory that is going to be revealed in us.
The road in.
The road in. That's right. Yeah. He says, creation is eagerly expecting the apocalypse of the children of God. There's going to be some unveiling of who
are the inheritors.
Yeah. When God's people are shown for who they really are, and all creation is waiting for that. You're like, what? That's interesting. So he goes on a little aside here, as Paul often does. He says, for creation was subjected to futility. And that word subjected is the word like enslaved or put under the authority of another.
Okay.
So what he's talking about is the exile of Adam and Eve from Eden, and then the cosmic impact of the spread of violence and death on the land. So in putting creation under the authority of humans, there was a risk involved there.
Yeah.
And when humans chose to do what's good in their own eyes, creation all of a sudden was enslaved to really bad overlords. But God subjected creation to futility. It's a great way to summarize human history. Not willingly, but in hope. Even though God handed creation over to really bad overlords, he subjected it in hope. So think here, Genesis 3:15, about the promise of the seed of the woman. In that hope was that creation itself would be set free from slavery to decay into the glorious freedom of the children of God.
Okay.
So creation needs to be set free from its slavery to decay, that is to death, freed to become what God intended it to be when it's not being ruined by humans. And he calls that freedom the glorious freedom of the children of God. So somehow when humans are set free from death, creation is also set free from futility and decay.
This is then some sort of cosmic inheritance?
Okay, yeah. So here's what, this was also N.T. Wright, his work on Romans 8 helped me here. There's actually, he's got three stories embedded within each other here.
Okay.
The largest level one is God and creation and humans.
Okay.
And so creation was handed over to futility, to bad overlords.
Okay.
And so in a way, like corrupt humans become Pharaoh, from which creation needs to be delivered.
Okay.
And so as he's going to say in verse 22, for we know that the whole creation is groaning. And that word groaning.
The groaning.
Is the groaning.
Oh, so creation now is, in the story of the Exodus,
the enslaved Israelites.
The enslaved Israelites and all of humanity
are the pharaohs.
Are the pharaohs.
Yes. Oh, this is so remarkable.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
And so creation is like enslaved Israel groaning, and that was exactly the phrase. He's using the language from the end of Exodus chapter 2.
Oh, okay.
They cried out from their slavery and their groans rose up to God.
Oh, wow.
So that's the meta story. Humans have become Pharaoh. And we're ruining each other and creation subject to a bad Pharaoh, and it's groaning. But then, second embedded story, he says, not only this, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we are also groaning as we await our adoption, the redemption of our bodies.
So our Exodus.
So now, inside of that groaning creation with bad overlords.
Yeah. The pharaohs need their own exodus.
Are groaning humans. So the pharaohs are themselves enslaved to, and he calls it the redemption of our body, which means a liberation from death. So now humans are a slave to a pharaoh, and that pharaoh is death. And that, it's really...
it's two layers of pharaohs.
It's really nuanced.
Yeah.
But you kind of see how it works.
Yeah.
Creation is enslaved to pharaohs, who is us, and we are enslaved to a bigger, badder pharaoh, which is death.
And we're all groaning.
So here, we're to the ideas that we explored in the city series and in the dragon, which is the fear of death, the reality of death, and then our fear of that death is a motivator for so much of our behavior that's harmful to ourselves and other people. What if that fear of death was off the table because you knew that you're liberated? It would lead you to, would lead me to treat you differently, right? Treat our neighbors differently and to treat the world differently. It's kind of the nutshell here. But there's one more story, too, of groaning. There's one more layer.
Oh.
Because he says, as we are awaiting groaning, we are groaning for our liberation, as creation groans for its liberation. Verse 26, and likewise, the spirit, so the life presence of God that is within us.
Yeah, that carries us on the way.
Helps us in our weakness, for we don't even know how to pray as we ought to. So...
we don't even know how to groan. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, we groan.
Yeah.
But there are some times where the tragedies and the complexities of life here in this futile world outside Eden, it's so complicated and it seems so hopeless. How do we groan? How do we pray? So he says the Spirit intercedes for us with groanings that words cannot express, or with inexpressible groaning. And the one who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit because he intercedes on behalf of the saints according to the will of God. He's doing heavy duty, like Trinitarian theology here. So within a groaning world, a groaning humans, and then within the groaning children of God is the Spirit of God, who is also groaning.
But the Spirit's not groaning because the Spirit needs to be set free. The Spirit is groaning as an intercessor.
As an intercessor. That's right. So I think this is what Paul's saying, and this is all built off of the groaning of the enslaved Israelites, is that when we groan, when our hearts break and we feel so overloaded with anxiety because life is so sad and complex and such terrible things happen and we don't know what to do or to say, Paul wants me to interpret that experience as God's own grief and lament, stirring me to lament, so that my groaning and laments are actually the Spirit of God groaning through me, because God hears the language of the Spirit, because the Spirit is God. So the Father hears the groaning of the Spirit in my groanings that are within a groaning creation.
Yeah.
And the whole premise of this then is, well, what did God do when he heard the groans in Exodus? He raised up a deliverer.
And those groans were good enough, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
God responded.
Yeah.
Raised up a deliverer.
That's right.
But is there something here about, but there continues to be the cycling?
Yes. The cosmic Exodus cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is part of Paul's and Jesus's, but this is Paul's way of talking about how God's response is not simply to raise up a new Moses deliverer, but that God actually becomes the new Moses deliverer, God's own self. And then that new Moses becomes the Passover lamb. God subjects God's own self to the death and suffering that we inflict on each other. God's present in the pain. God participates in the pain as the one who can deliver us out of it. And man, this is just a profound passage. But it's all built off of the Exodus motif of the enslavement leading to groaning, leading to the hope of redemption. A cosmic redemption, resurrection redemption, and the unleashing of new creation. It's a cosmic Exodus. Paul thought of the death and resurrection of Jesus in Passover Exodus terms. He thought of the journey of the life of a Christian as a perpetual enactment, recycling of the Exodus story, and he sees all of creation as an Exodus cosmic story.
Okay, well, that's it for our journey through this theme, the Exodus way.
Okay, now we have two special episodes coming out.
Yeah, so next week we're going to talk with Dr. N.T. Wright.
Yes.
In the studio with us.
Yeah, that's right. He was in town. He stopped by and spent some time with us, and we got to talk about yet another element of the Exodus story, which is the passage through the waters and the meaning of baptism. Super cool.
Yes. We're going to talk about with one of our scholars here. Can I say what it is?
Please.
The seven women in Exodus, chapters 1-4.
Yes.
There's something really special going on there.
Very cool.
Super cool. Of course, we'll also do a question and response episode, and then I guess we'll finally be done.
Okay. Yeah. And there's more to it. And actually, just because we stopped talking about it doesn't mean y'all who are listening have to stop thinking about it. We've got a whole bunch more stuff about this series and ideas in it.
Yeah. If you've been listening along in real time, especially, you're kind of getting primed with us. There's going to be a lot of cool resources that we're putting out that then you can use to bring to your family, to your church, or just for yourself to go deeper in this conversation.
Yep.
And so we've got a theme video coming out.
Man, we just saw the updated version yesterday, real time.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
It's in our doodle style, which we've done maybe 4 or 5 videos in. The animation studio now calls it Doodle Deluxe because it's gotten a lot more special.
Great. We've also got this new thing we've been doing called a guide page on our website that walks you through the ideas that we've discussed in the series and the video.
Yeah, almost think of it like a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
Everything we've walked through, it's connected to all the resources that we have.
Yep. We have group study notes.
Yeah.
So let's say you set aside 4 or 5 Friday nights at your house. Make a meal, and we've got a thing that can help you facilitate that.
Yeah, some passages to read, some questions to ask. You can use the video as a primer.
Yeah, if you've learned a lot, just like we did, you could help the people you know. We're going to have all of those resources on our website.
Yep, BibleProject.com or the Bible Project app. We'll see you there.
Yeah.
I guess I won't see you there.
You'll see that stuff there.
You'll see that stuff there.
Yeah, that's right.
That works.
Cool.
Baie welkom. Is heerlik om jou saam met jou te wees ook in hierdie tweede deel van die program, nadat ons na Tim en John geluister het. Paulus, wat hierdie Exodus taal, uittocht taal, die taal van die pad, die weg, so baie mooi gebruik, is deel van sy hele verstaan en hoe die Heer hom voorberei het, om nou die woord te bring aan Jode en nie-Jode, vooral nie-Jode, uit die heidendom. Dit is hoe die Here hom geroep het, om uit te gaan en hierdie moeilike beginwerk te doen. Jesus, soos wat ons dit in Matteus sien, was baie meer gerig voor sy, tot met sy dood, op die Jode. Dit het net die nie-Jode uitgesluit, en daarom is daar al hierdie verhale van die hoofman, van die Romeine, van die vrou, die Kanaanitiese vrou, en hy gaan ook selfs buiten Jerusalem ook, ach, buiten Israël sy gebied ook, soms, maar sy focus was op die Jode. En dan wys Matteus, soos wat ons reflekteer hier op Matteus 11, vooral vir ons na, aan hierdie hele hoofstuk, eers, natuurlijk praat hy van Johannes die Doper, wat vraag, maar is hy die een wat sou kom? Die twyfel, omdat Jesus so totaal anders en die koninkryk van God so totaal anders lyk as wat die Jode verwag het, selfs Johannes, het hierdie twyfel, en maar hy vra, hy stuur sy disippels na Jesus en vra, omdat hy deur God gestuur is om die weg oop te maak vir die Messias, maar selfs hy het dit nie heeltemal verstaan nie. Dan sê Jesus, maar kyk wat gebeur. Die melaates word gereinig, die verlamdes loop, die blindes sien, die dowes hoor, en dooies word opgewek, en armes word die goeie boodskap verkondig. Gelukkig is die mens wat nie aan my aanstoot neem nie. En dan kan die mens dink dat Johannes dan weet, maar dit is die Messias, dit is die een wat hy die weg voor oopgemaak het, deur sy prediking oor die koninkryk en sy voorbeeld. En dan sê Jesus juist ook oor hierdie stede waar hy groot geword het, waar hy al hierdie dinge wat hy vir Johannes gesê het, gedoen het. En maar hulle wou nie dit aanvaar en glo nie. En dan sê die Here dit voel so duidelik hoe moeilik dit is. En dat ons soos kindertjies moet word. Maar kom ons lees hierdie gedeelte wat ons vandag na kyk. Maar dit is die agtergrond daarvan, die twyfel, hoe moeilik dit is om regtig jou eie gedagtes net te stop en te luister na dit wat die Here vir ons sê, wie hy is en hoe sy koninkryk lyk. Jesus sê, toe het Jesus begin in vers 20, in Matteus 11, om die stede waarin die meeste van sy kragtige dade plaasgevind het te verwyd, omdat hulle nie bekeer het nie. Wee jou Gerasin, wee jou Betsaida, want as die kragtige dade wat in julle plaasgevind het, in Tyrus en Sidon gebeur het, sou hulle lank al in as en sak in as gesit en hulle bekeer het. Maar ek sê vir julle, vir Tyrus en Sidon, sal het op die oordeelsdag draagliker wees as vir julle. En jy, Kapernaum, sal jy tot die hemel toe verhoog word? Nee, jy sal na Hades afdaal. Want as in Sodom die kragtige dade plaasgevind het, wat in jou plaasgevind het, sou dit bly staan het tot vandag toe? Maar ek sê vir julle, dit sal vir die gebied van Sodom op die oordeelsdag draagliker wees as vir jou. Tjoe, harde woorde van Jesus hierdie nie. Hy wys hier hoe die Jode van sy tyd weier om die boodskap van die uittog uit die slawerny in die koninkryk van God in, hoe dit verdag gemaak word deur die boodskapper verdag te maak. Nou, as jy nog gaan kyk na wat die Here het in die vorige verse gesê het, dan is dit duidelik hoe mense dieselfde argument sommer omdraai op verskillende maniere as hulle jou of die koninkryk dan van die Here liewers wil verdag maak. Hulle gebruik dieselfde argument. Hulle sê van Johannes, hy het nie geëet en gedrink nie. As hy dan so lewe soos hy, dan moet hy van die demoon besete wees. Van Jesus sê hulle, hy eet en drink, en hy is 'n vraat en 'n suiplap. Hy hou van sy partytjies, kos en drank, sou ons vandag sê. Hy is 'n rebelse seun wat Israel verlei, 'n valse profeet. En dan is dit eintlik maklik om sommer maar net dadelik te besef waarmee hulle besig is, dat hulle verwys na die Ou Testament, wat eintlik sê dat as daar 'n rebelse seun is of 'n valse profeet, moet hy doodgemaak word. Johannes die Doper lei hierdie asketiese lewe van selfverloning en preek oor die koninkryk van God. Maar dis te moeilik om so te leef. Dit is so anders as wat ons dink dit moet wees. Hy moet 'n demoon hê. En hier kom Jesus en hy preek oor die koninkryk van God. Hy leer hulle om te bid, laat u koninkryk kom, laat u wil geskied. Die koninkryk van God wat kom, Maar dan sê hulle, kyk wat doen hy. Ja, kyk wat doen hy, want hy hou partytjies. Partytjies wat praat van God se vrygewige liefde en vergifnis. Die Engelse woord generosity, sy vrygewigheid. Meer, maar as generosity is meer as vergewigheid. Dis die gelykenis van die verlore seun, die pa wat uithardloop wanneer hierdie seun terugkom. God se liefde en vergifnis. Maar dan draai hulle dit net so om. Sê, maar hy wil dan so leef. Nie met sak en as so sy kop en ernstig en bid op die strate. Hy moet 'n rebelse seun wees, soos Deuteronomium dit beskryf. 'N valse profeet. Ja, hulle sê dit nie reguit nie. Maar hulle lê dit so subtiel neer, soos mense baie keer doen. Jesus egter noem dit by die naam. Hy sê vir hulle presies wat hulle doen. Johannes en nou Jesus nooi en roep hulle om in 'n nuwe rigting in te gaan. Weg van die ou manier van godsdiens. Die ou denke oor die Messias wat hulle gaan verlos van die Romeinse juk of watter oorheerser daar ook al is en hulle weer sentraal maak in die wêreld, die Israel volk, om in die vloei van God se liefde te kom. Dis wat hy bring, wat uitborrel en waai. En as ek nou hier na buite kyk en ek sien die bome en die blaartjies wat net so val, selfs hierdie tyd van die jaar, dis die ou blare wat val as die wind so waai en dan kom daar nuwes uit en groei. Ja, dit is wat God bring. Die ou blare, die ou denke, wat moet afwaai, loskom, wegkom, sodat die nuwes kan uitkom. Jesus roep hulle om weg te draai van hierdie ou godswettiese en godsdienstige juk wat die godsdienstige leiers op hulle lê. En in die wind van God se liefde en sy genade te kom. Sit nie by jou ook 'n dors? En tog verdring ons ou denke van hoe ons dink dit moet wees. Baie dikwels hierdie forsheid en hierdie ligtheid van die wind van God, sy ruach, sy gees. Maar nee, hulle wil nie. Hulle wil vashou. Hulle maak hom liefers vir dag, hulle beplan om hom liefers dood te maak. As om te verander van denke. En dit is dan wanneer hierdie harde woorde van Jesus kom oor Gerasen en Betsaida, Kapernaum waar hy groot geword het. Hoekom gebruik die Here hierdie harde woorde? Was hy kwaad? Harde woorde, ja. Maar ernstig, dit kom diep uit sy hart. Seker diep teleurstellende woorde. Hartseer eintlik. So was die Here oor hulle wat hulle hart vir hart het en nie wou hoor nie. Hierdie stede waar hy gewoon het. Onthou, hy ken hierdie mense. Dis sy maats, sy vriende gewees, sy bure. Die mense met wie hy saam sinagoge toe gegaan het, kerk toe gegaan het. Saam met wie hy saam geleer het. Jy is hier, waar hy al hierdie groot wonderwerke ook gedoen het. Mense wat gesond word, sy helende werk. Mense het dit gesien. maar hulle denke oor hoe hulle dink oor Godse koninkryk. Een koninkryk van mag en geweld om die Romeinse onderdrukker te oorwin. God het immers toch beloof, hy sal die Messias stuur. Jy moet jou naaste lief hê, maar jou vyand haat eintlik. As hy jou op een wang slaan, slaan hom op die ander wang. Dit is die koninkryk wat hulle soek. Vergelding en uitruk hulle dink. Dit is wat het beteken. Is weer soos met Egypte, dat die Here hulle daar uitlei, hulle vry maak. Jesus weet, hulle verwag dit, hulle wil dit hê. En hy weet wat gaan met Jerusalem en die Jode gebeur. En daarom sê hy vir hulle, dis beter met julle as met Sodom, dis beter met Sodom en Gomorra, wat met vuur en haal geslaan is, as om soos julle vas te hou aan julle ou denke. Die koninkryk wat hy elke dag geleef het in die dorpe met liefde, met gelag en vriendskap, met brood uitdeel en visse, met sy teenwoordigheid. Hy het gewys hoe kragtig sy heelmakings was. Maar hulle kies die ander pad. Kruit om eerder uit vir een vraat en een wijnsuiper. So, lieve luisteraar, ons kan nou sê, jy kan het nie glo nie. Waarin wil ek vir jou vra vandag, hou jy so vas, dat jy nie wil oorgee aan die een wat heel maak en nieuwe lewe bring? Waarin hou jy so vas om nie in die vol stroom van die Heilige Gees te kom en sy liefde en blydskap te ervaar in jou? Wat is so belangrik in jou lewensplanne wat jy dink moet gebeur? Waaroor jy jou bekommer in die nag? Waaroor jy beklei in die dag? Op die pad waar jy is, al is het baie godsdienstig, baie keer is het. Dis nie net die wat nie godsdienstig is nie, dis juist dit, wanneer jy so vasthou aan dinge dat jy liefste mense wegstoot, dat jy valse indrukke bring. Want jy dink dit is die regte pad. Maak jou hart oop vir die Here self, vir sy liefde en sy omgee, vir die goeie nuus van Jesus ons Here. Terwyl jy daaroor dink en reflekteer, kom ons luister na musiek en dan gesels ons verder hieroor. So wanneer jy dan tot stilstand kom, en hoor hoe die Here sê, sy koninkryk is so anders. Kom na hom. Dan hoor ons hierdie woorde, en ek lees het hierdie volgende paar verse in Matteus 11, vers 25. In daardie tyd het Jesus gesê, ek loof u, Vader, Here van hemel en aarde, dat u hierdie dinge vir slim en geleerde mense verberg, en dit aan kindertjies bekend gemaak het. Ja, Vader, want so het u dit goed gevind. Alles is deur my Vader aan my toe vertrou. En niemand ken die Seun nie, behalwe die Vader. En niemand ken die Vader nie, behalwe die Seun en elkeen aan wie die Seun hom bekend wil maak. Kom na my toe, almal wat vermoeid en swaar belas is, en ek sal julle rus gee. Neem my juk op julle en leer van my, omdat ek sagmoedig en nederig van hart is, en julle sal rus vind vir julle gemoed. Want my juk is draaglik, en my las is lig. So, na hierdie woorde van Jesus, hierdie helder woorde, kan een mens nie glo dat daar toch die is wat hom verdag wil maak, en hom wil doodmaak. Hulle wat gehoor het, en wat vandag ook hoor, maar nie wil weet nie. Die wil ken nie. Die wat nie die koninkryk, wat so anders is as die van die wêreld, wil omhels nie. Het gaan nie oor godsdienst nie. Het gaan oor Jesus self en sy lewe, sy koninkryk, wat hy wil gee. Mense wat in hierdie wêreld van oog vir oog en 'n tand vir 'n tand, hierdie wêreld van geweld, mense wat nie hierdie koninkryk van liefde en genade en vergifnis wil hê nie, wat vashou aan hulle eie denke, soos hier in Jesus' tyd, wat hy hier beskryf, Matteus in duidelike taal, die koninkryk wat so duidelik deur Jesus met die bergrede oopgemaak is, sodat mense kan verstaan. Die koninkryk waar God alles weer heel maak. Jesus spreek nie maar net nie. Hy leef dit self uit. Dit is die koninkryk van lag en van blydskap. Die koninkryk van liefde en vrede. Die koninkryk waar ons die waarheid selfs in liefde praat. Koninkryk van nuwe lewe. Nie swaar godsdienstig nie. 'N swaar juk wat op ons skouers lê. Sodat ander kan sien ook hoe godsdienstig ons is, en ons glo dit ten volle. 'N koninkryk wat mense, en ook ons soms, nie in glo nie. Omdat ons self die las van ons eie planne wil dra, ons eie bekommernisse. Ons wil self aanvaarding hê in hierdie wêreld. Ons wil self sekuriteit skep, veiligheid vir onsself. Ons dink ons kan dit doen. Nee, my liewe luisteraar, Jesus lewe 'n ander koninkryk, 'n koninkryk van lewe en vreugde. Lewe in die gees. Sy wêreld was nie anders nie, was 'n wêreld van geweld. Sy eie mense. En die wat hom hoor en nie glo nie, wil homself doodmaak. Hierdie koninkryk waarvan Jesus praat, kry mens nie met swaar wettiese godsdienstige laste nie. Jy hoef nie jare daarvoor te werk en te studeer nie. Al die tale te ken en kennis te hê nie. Nee, Jesus sê hier vir ons, jy hoef net soos 'n klein kindjie te wees. Hy self het dit geken as die seun van die Vader. Hy self het dit ervaar hoe dit groei in hom, soos wat hy opgegroei het. En daarom gebruik die Here die woord hier die Vader, die Seun. Hierdie woord vir Seun is hier die woord Joos, die Seun. Dis iemand wat nie technisch, daar was een Griekse woord daarvoor ook, technisch wettiglike Seun is nie. Maar werkelijk iemand wat een verhouding met sy pa het, een Seun en een pa verhouding. Ja, Jezus het het gelewe. Hy het in die verhouding met sy vader gestaan. Ja, hy het selfs nie, soos die godsdienstige leiers deur die jare die Torah en die profete bestudeer nie. Hy het nie een papier gehad wat hom gekwalificeer het as die beste geleerde nie. Hy het op een intieme wijze die Vader geken. In sy teenwoordigheid gelewe. Na sy stem geluister. En nou sien hy dit self. En hy ervaar dit self. Dat het juist die kinderlik is. Die tollenaars en die sondaars. Die gewone mense is wat hom volg. Om begin hoor en verstaan. Van die koninkryk van God. En dit is hier waar Jezus nou sê, dat die wat hom ken, aan wie hy dit bekend maak, dit oopmaak. Die woord apokalipsie beteken iets wat 'n groot gebeurtenis is, word bekend. Wat hy bring, die koninkryk, is 'n groot gebeurtenis. En wanneer jy tot hom kom, lieve luisteraar, en die gees in jou kom en jou woon, dan gaan dit oop. Dis 'n apokalips. Dis iets wat jy weet wat gebeur. En dan sê Jesus hier, hy doen dit aan die wat kinderlik is, wat hom wat hulle hande uithou en hom ontvang. Die wat hom volg, die naam te luister en intiem met hom om te gaan, wat alles tot stilstand bring in hulle en dan hom ken en sy teenwoordigheid is. Kom ons neem 'n paar oomblikke terwyl die musiek speel oor die radio. Dink ons hieroor en dan skakel ons weer in vir die laaste gedagte dan uit Matteus 11. Bly ingeskakel. Welkom terug by hierdie laaste gedeelte oor Matteus 11, die ABBA-program. En ons luister juist hierna. Liewe luisterjaars, Jesus probeer nie mense net oorreed nie. Nee, wanneer hy praat, dan kan jy maar net in oor luister. En om dan nog te sien wat hy doen, hoe hy mense deur sy wonderdade gesond maak, die sonde wat gebreek het, die heel maak in mense, hy maak hulle heel, selfs mense uit die dood opgewek. Jy moet baie sterk aan jou wêreld en jou denke en jou godsdienstigheid vashou om hom nie te volg nie. En toch is dit precies wat gebeur het. Maar dan, hierdie woorde van die Here, dit is so intiem persoonlik. Hoor jy dit ook nou vandag? Kom na my toe, sê hy. Almal wat vermoeid en swaar belas is, en ek sal julle rus gee. Maar dit klink daarom te maklik. Maar dit is nie maklik. Dit is nie maklik as jy vasthou aan jou eie verstaan van die lewe. As jy jouself, jou eie identiteit wil bou in hierdie lewe, as jy As jy alles onder jou beheer wil probeer bring, ja, dan klink dit hom te maklik wat hy hier sê. Dit klink by iets wat te goed is om waar te wees en die mense sê mos, as iets so klink, dan is dit te goed om waar te wees. Maar het Jesus dan nie self gesê, dat nie baie ingaan. Want jy moet alles laat gaan. Hy het selfs op 'n keer gesê, familiebesittings, selfs jou eie lewe. Ja, dan is dit toch nie so maklik nie. En toch sê hy hier die woorde, in die midde van dit alles vir jou. Kom na my toe. En wanneer jy sy stem hoor en jy ervaar die beweging van die Gees in jou, want hy maak dit aan jou bekend, hy maak dit oop, apokalips, iets groots gebeur, en daar kom die lig, en jy word ook opgelig deur die Gees. En die laste val van jou skouers af. Die laste wat jy self en ander ook op jou gelê het. Jy word lig soos 'n veertjie in die midde van al hierdie stikkende goed. En daar kom rus deur sy sagtheid. Sy omgee, sy liefde en goedheid, wat deur Jesus sy hele wese straal. En dan, liewe luisteraar, dan lig die laste, al hierdie swaar godsdienstigheid, al hierdie wette, die dinge waaraan jy dink jy moet voldoen, lichamelik, finansieel, emosionele laste, dit lig, wat jy staan in sy teenwoordigheid, in sy midde. Hoor jy dit? Dit is so anders as die wat Jesus, een streng polisieman of een kwaai hoofonderwijser of een te vroom hoofouderling oor jou maak. Hy veroordeel jou nie. Maak nie saak wat mense sê nie. Hy sê, hoor jy my stem as ek jou roep? Ontvang jy my genade wanneer ek dit gee? Hoor jy my? Dit is wie die Vader is. Dit is sy hart ook vir jou. Soos jy my hoor en ken, so ken jy die Vader. Dit is hoe goed en sagmoedig hy is. Hoor en volg my. Kom tot stilstand. Neem net 'n oomblik en stop. En sny al die ander dinge uit jou denke. Al jou planne oor hoe jou lewe moet werk. Al jou vrese, jou verwagtings. Kom hier in my teenwoordigheid. Draai na my en sien my liefde vir jou, want dit is die Vader se liefde. Ontvang die lewe, sy geregtigheid, sy regte lewe. Dit is joune. En volg my. Volg die Here deur sy Gees wat in jou woon, dan sal jou gedagtes oor wat belangrik vir jou en dit wat jy vrees, dit sal al daai gedagtes tot stilstand bring. En jy sal deur die Gees my stem hoor, my woord. Neem my juk op jou en leer van my, omdat ek sagmoedig en nederig van hart is, en jy sal rus vind vir jou gemoed. Dankie Here, dat ons in U teenwoordigheid kan kom, dat ons U kan ken, U kan hoor. Laat al die ander stemme net weggaan. Want ek wil net U volg. U stem hoor. En in hierdie stikkende wêreld op 'n heel manier lewe, U koninkryk lewe. Dankie Here vir U genade oor elkeen wat nou aan U voete is. Amen. Dit was heerlik om hierdie wonderlike boodskap met jou te deel. Wat 'n voorreg is dit nie. Ons gesels volgende week weer verder. Totsiens.
Hierdie inset was aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.